You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Earlier this week, North Korea detonated a nuclear weapon. In response, the U.S. asked the United Nations to issue sanctions against North Korea, enforceable by military use. President Bush suggested that the U.S. might use its own nuclear arsenal against North Korea in the event of noncompliance. Joseph Gerson is the director of the Peace and Economic Security Program for the American Friends Society in New England, and he's also author of a forthcoming book. It's titled Empire and the Bomb, How the United States Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. He joins me on the line now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, to tell us more about the implications of the U.S. response to North Korea. Welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, Joseph.
Good morning.
Even with this week's test, there's no evidence that North Korea has the means to directly attack the United States. So what are the stakes of the current conflict?
Well, I think the biggest immediate danger is actually the possibility of a nuclear arms race in Northeast Asia, whereas certainly people in British Columbia will understand the historic divisions and tensions are quite great. The fear has long been that if North Korea got a bomb, it would reinforce the kind of military nationalism in Japan, so that Japan would go nuclear, which in turn would frighten China and spark a regional spiraled arms race.
And the new prime minister of Japan is a person who has been eager to rearm Japan and get away from their post-war constitution preventing armament.
Right. I mean, most people don't understand that Japan, over the last decade or more, has been the world's second or third biggest military spender, despite its so-called peace constitution. And the constitution has been regularly violated, for example, with the dispatch of troops to Iraq. But with Abe coming to power, we have a man who is, one can't be held fully accountable for one's parents or grandparents, but he's the grandson of a Class A war criminal who the CIA nurtured to become prime minister. And he's long been in favor of Japan becoming a nuclear power. So this certainly provides him a political cover to follow through with the campaign to essentially eliminate Japan's peace constitution and to battle with the very deep and entrenched popular resistance to nuclear weapons in Japan.
This isn't the first time the United States has had a major confrontation with North Korea over nuclear weapons. Go back a decade ago to when Bill Clinton was president.
Right.
Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I think we need to understand this in its deeper context. The United States has prepared or threatened to initiate nuclear attacks against North Korea at least 8 times over the last 55 years. Beginning in 1950 with the Korean War. And from a Korean perspective, they are surrounded by threatening forces, more than 200 U.S. Military bases in South Korea and Japan, the nuclear-armed 7th Fleet, and so on. And with a policy, certainly going back into the Clinton era in the United States, of regime change. So my take is that the North Korean bomb is served essentially two functions, at least its nuclear weapons project, and that has been to provide it, an incredibly poor country at this stage, with a bargaining chip to come into the Pacific economy for the 21st century, and to reinforce the survival of a dictatorial government against perceived threats from the outside. In 1994, as you said, the Clinton administration nearly stumbled into a nuclear war with Korea. Clinton didn't understand that he simply made demands on Korea, given the kind of national pride that exists there. If he drew red lines, that these were unlikely to be respected, that Kim Il-sung at that time was unlikely to jump to Clinton's command, and he certainly didn't. And in that case, we came much closer to nuclear war than any of us understood. And it took Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter's inspired intervention to negotiate what was called the agreed framework which basically led the North Koreans to put their nuclear program under IAEA inspection, and led the U.S. to make a number of commitments to provide energy, alternative nuclear power plants, and so on, some of which were provided and many of which were not.
And how has the Bush administration affected the efforts to continue some negotiations with North Korea?
Well, like most of its foreign and military policy, its policies towards Korea have been an absolute disaster. In the latter Clinton years, they finally woke up and were really on the verge of negotiating a comprehensive deal with North Korea, which would have addressed both the country's missiles and its nuclear weapons. Albright, as listeners may remember, Secretary of State Albright traveled to North Korea shortly before the U.S. elections. But when the 2000 election was up for grabs here, Clinton thought it was impolitic for him to go to North Korea to close the deal. In one of its first moves, the Bush administration humiliated South Korea's Prime Minister, Kim Dae-jung, and derailed the diplomacy with North Korea. And as everybody knows, it's been a roller coaster for the last 6 years.
What have the North Korean government said about the prospect for renewed talks?
Well, they don't hold out a whole lot of hope here. One of their most consistent demands has been for bilateral negotiations with the United States. And the Bush administration refused this, I think afraid that those negotiations could be used to drive a wedge between the United States and South Korea, a wedge which, in fact, 55 years of history has opened up in the last few years. And in this context, the North Koreans, playing hardball, have moved ahead with their nuclear program. It's going to take some inspired diplomacy at this point to find a way through. Both Kofi Annan and former President Carter have reiterated that the way forward should be bilateral talks. Carter has suggested that if one way that the Bush administration could save face in this regard would be to secretly send someone like James Baker to North Korea to open a dialogue. Baker has said, and it's on public record, as saying that talking to your enemies is not appeasement. And one could hope that if there were progress in those discussions, that the six-party talks could then be used to build the foundation for a nuclear weapons-free zone in Northeast Asia. And that's clearly one of the important next steps to provide security there.
Now, if when we're living outside of this North American continent, which seems to be a bubble politically, you'd look at the United States. It signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It hasn't implemented any of it. It has a blind eye towards Israeli nuclear weapons. It wanted to push through supplying nuclear technology to India, even though it isn't a signer of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. How does it get away with this?
Well, one way it's gotten away with it so far has just been raw power and nuclear threats. Here in the United States, most people think, and even most of the press, thinks of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as simply a commitment by the non-nuclear states not to become nuclear powers, when in fact the treaty was perhaps one of the most important bargains of the 20th century, where in exchange for the non-nuclear powers forswearing getting nuclear weapons, the nuclear powers said that they would provide both technology for nuclear power generation and also in Article 6, as you said, negotiate the elimination of the nuclear arsenals. What's happened is that the world has waited a long time for the nuclear powers led by the United States to fulfill this commitment. And the combination of this hypocrisy plus the now more than 30 U.S. Threats to initiate nuclear war during crises and conflicts is the principal driving force for nuclear weapons proliferation. Again, we've got a double standard, as you pointed out, with the United States tolerating the nuclear arsenals of its allies and tacit allies, Israel, Pakistan, and India, whereas those that would challenge U.S. regional hegemony, for example, North Korea and Iran, are opposed as the worst thing to ever happen. And of course, along the way, as popular popular mobilization for confrontation is being built, we totally lose track of sight of the fact that there was a Cold War. The Soviets were then the most dangerous enemies. They had nuclear weapons, and we did in fact negotiate with them, negotiating very serious arms control agreements, and at one point coming fairly close to coming to an agreement to actually eliminate nuclear weapons.
Now, I understand that the week before the test in North Korea, a group of Japanese who are for the abolition of nuclear weapons, and some of whom were in fact survivors of Hiroshima, were touring in the United States. What message did they bring to people in the United States about the conflict with North Korea?
Well, they came to the U.S. to present more than a million signature petitions to the U.N. General Assembly calling for the negotiation of a nuclear weapons abolition treaty. The group then split in two, with some going to California, where they participated in protests at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, and then about 20 coming up here to the New England area. Their message was essentially that nuclear weapons and human beings cannot coexist, that if there's any hope for human survival, we have to negotiate their elimination. They held out some hope to U.S. people, especially U.S. peace movement people, by reminding us that, for example, last year, the U.N. General Assembly voted something like 151-5 for the negotiation of such a treaty. Countries that voted for it included U.S. allies, and those opposed were the U.S., Britain, France, India, and Israel. But to help us understand that those of us within the United States are not entirely alone. When asked about the reported preparations for a North Korean nuclear test, what they said was that one of the Hibakusha is also a physicist, was absolutely eloquent on this. He said that not only the use of nuclear weapons, but the possession of nuclear weapons is a crime of against humanity that simply cannot be tolerated. That said, they reminded people that the United States has about 15,000 deployed and stockpiled thermonuclear weapons, and explained that much of the world was aghast at the prospect of the world's most powerful nation appearing to be afraid of what was happening in North Korea, and that the only way forward was really patience and negotiations, and this is the way forward to real security.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning, Joseph.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Joseph Gerson. He is the director of the Peace and Economic Security Program for the American Friends Society in New England.